and me, and held his ground. Mouse didn't skip a beat after killing the serpent. This time he rushed forward, low, his snarls in chorus with the growling of thunder outside. He hit Cassius at the knees with the full power of his body, and Cassius went down like a ten-pin before a bowling ball. Butters rushed forward and kicked at Cassius's knife hand. The weapon skittered away again, over the edge of the gallery and into the great hall below. Cassius kicked at Butters and got him in the shins, sending Butters to the floor. Cassius got out from under Mouse and lurched for me, his eyes mad, his hands outstretched in strangling claws. Mouse landed on his back and the huge dog's jaws closed on the man's neck. Cassius froze in place in sudden terror, his eyes very wide. He stared at me. For a second, there was total silence. "I gave you a chance," I told him, my voice quiet. Quintus Cassius's liver-spotted face went pale with horrified comprehension.
"Wait."
"Mouse," I said. "Kill him." I had only one open eye with which to watch Cassius meet his end. But in that final second, rage and terror and horrified realization flashed through his eyes. And just as Mouse's jaws crushed the delicate bones of his neck, there was a flare of ugly energies, a flash of unholy purplish light around him, and he spoke words that rang in echoes totally out of proportion to their volume.
"Die alone," he spat.
A flood of power hit me, and my vision went black. The last thing I heard was the snapping of bone. Chapter 38. I didn't wake up. It was more like I felt myself putting together some kind of awareness, the way a stagehand constructs a set. Evidently, I was a minimalist because the reality I awoke to was a bare black floor, a single hanging lamp overhead, and three chairs. I walked forward into the light and stared at the chairs. In one sat Lashiel, again in her angelic, blonde, wholesome form. She wasn't wearing the white tunic, though. Instead, she was clothed in an Illinois Department of Corrections prison jumpsuit. The orange suited her hair and complexion quite well. She wore prison shackles, wrists and feet, and sat primly in her chair. In the second chair was me. Well, it was a version of me. Some kind of subconscious alter ego of mine. His hair was clipped shorter and neater than mine, and he wore a dark beard that was kept in similar fastidious order. He wore a black silk shirt, black trousers, and his hands, both of them, were unmarred, his fingertips held together in a steeple that rested on his chin. "Another dream," I said, and sighed. I slumped down into the third chair. I looked more or less as I had when I woke up that morning. My shirt was slashed open, though there wasn't any blood on my torso, and my skin hadn't been pounded and ripped with a chain, wishful thinking. "Not precisely a dream," the subconscious me said. "Call it a meeting of the minds." Lashiel smiled, very slightly. "No," I said, and pointed at Lashiel. "I've said everything I intend to say to her." I turned to my alter ego, though on thinking about it, maybe alter id was more accurate. "As for you, you're sort of a jerk, and the whole look you've got going there says evil wizard, which I am now professionally opposed to." Alterna Harry sighed. "I've told you before, I'm not some sort of dark demon. I'm simply the more primal essence of yourself, the one most concerned with such matters as food. Survival." His dark eyes flickered idly over Lashiel. "Mating," he said, a lazy growl to the tone. He looked back to me. "The important things in life." "That I am even having this dream probably means that I need a good therapist," I said. I stared at my other self and said, "It was you, wasn't it? You wanted to pick up the coin." "Make sure you remember that I am a part of you before you point any fingers," he said. "And yes, The potential for power in an alliance with Lashiel, he inclined his head to her, a courtly, gentlemanly gesture, damn his chivalrous eyes, was too great to simply ignore. There are too many things out there determined to kill you. So long as you keep Lashiel's coin, you both have the option to seek more power, if necessary, to protect yourself or others. And you prevent the coin from being used by unscrupulous sorts like Cassius. I grimaced. So, he said, this is a time to consider employing a portion of that power. I stared at him and said, you've been talking to her behind my back. 4 months, he said calmly. It was only polite. After all, you wanted nothing to do with her. You asshole, I said. The whole reason I wasn't talking was that I didn't want the temptation. I did, my subconscious said. Honestly, you should listen to me more often. If you'd taken my advice about Murphy, she wouldn't be in Hawaii, in bed with Kincaid. Lashiel coughed gently and said, gentlemen, if I might offer a suggest... Both I and my alternative self said, at the same time and in exactly the same voice, shut up. Lashiel blinked, but did. My double and I eyed each other, and I nodded slowly. We're in agreement, then, that her presence and her influence are dangerous. We are, my double said. She must not be allowed to dictate actions or to direct our choices through suggestion or manipulation, my double looked at her and said. But she can and should be used as a resource under careful control. She can offer us enormous amounts of information. He eyed her again and said, and amusement. Lashiel left her eyes down and smiled, very slightly. No, I said. I've got Bob when I want information, and if I want sex, I'll figure out something. You don't have Bob now, my double said, and you've wanted sex since about 20 minutes after the last time you had it. That's beside the point, I told him sullenly. I'm not quite insane enough to let a fallen angel give me virtual nookie just for kicks. Listen to me, he said, and his voice became sharp, commanding. Here's the cold truth. You are determined to take us into battle against forces you cannot possibly overcome through main strength. Not only that, but your source of assistance, the wardens, may also turn against you if they learn the truth about what you're attempting. You are wounded. You are out of contact with your other allies. It's the right thing to do, I said, setting my jaw. My double rolled his eyes. Tell me, is it morally necessary for you to die in the process? I glowered at him. This meeting is just a formality, you know, he said. You are already planning on asking Lashiel's shadow for her help. That's why you read through the book as you did, before it was taken from you. You wanted it to go through your mind so that she could see it, and provide you with the text as she did for the summoning of the Earl King. I lifted a finger. I only did that in case I wasn't able to pry enough out of Gravain to figure out exactly what Kemmler's disciples are doing. My double arched a brow. How'd that work out for you? Don't be a wise ass, I said. The point, he said, is that you have little or no chance to prevail if you blindly rush in. You must know how they intend to manipulate these energies. You must know if there is a weak time or place at which to assault them. You must know the details of the Dark Hollow, or you might as well cut your own wrists. Don't have to, I told him. I could just sit and wait for the Earl King to come by. Six of one, half a dozen of another, my double agreed. In addition, your body is in no condition to do anything at the moment, he leaned forward. Free her to help us. I inhaled slowly and stared at Lashiel for a moment. Then I said, after I killed Justin and got my head together at Ebenezer's place, I promised myself something. I promised that I would live my life on my own terms, that I knew the difference between right and wrong, and that I wouldn't cross the line. I wouldn't allow myself to become like Justin de Morne. Don't you want to survive? My double asked. I rose from the chair and started walking into the darkness outside the light. Of course I do, but some things are more important than survival. Yeah, my double said. Like the people who are going to get killed when you die and don't stop Kemmler's disciples. I froze at the edge of the darkness. Take the high road if you want to, my double said. Choose to walk away from this strength in the name of principle. But after your noble death, everyone you no longer protect, everyone who might one day have come to you for help, everyone who was killed in the aftermath of the Dark Hallow, every life you might have protected in the future will be on your head. I stared at the darkness and then closed my eyes. Regardless of where it came from, Lashiel offers you the power of knowledge. If you turn aside from that power, power only you can take up, then you abandon your commitment to protect and defend those who are not strong enough to do it themselves. No, I said. That isn't my responsibility. Of course it is, my subconscious said, voice clear and sharp. You coward. I stopped and turned, staring at him. If you go to your death, rather than do everything you might to prevent what is happening, you are merely committing suicide and trying to make yourself feel better about it. That is the act of a coward. It is beneath contempt. I went through the logic of his argument and didn't make any headway against it, of course. While my double might look like another person, he wasn't. He was me. If I open this door now, I said slowly, I might not be able to close it again. Or you might, my double said. I have no intention of allowing her any control, so you will be the one who determines it. What if I can't contain her again once she's freed? Why shouldn't you be able to? It's your mind, your will, your choice. You still believe in free will, do you not? It's dangerous, I said. Of course it is. And now you must choose. Will you face that danger? Or will you run from it, and so condemn those who need your strength to their deaths? I stared at him for a minute. Then I looked at Lashiel. She waited, her eyes steady, her expression calm. Can you do it? I asked her bluntly. Can you show me what was on those pages? Of course, she answered, her manner one of subservience without a trace of resentment. I would be pleased to offer you whatever assistance you permit. She looked humble. She looked cooperative. But I knew better. The mere shadow of the fallen angel Lashiel was a vital and powerful force. She might look humble and cooperative, but if that was her true nature, she wouldn't have fallen to begin with. I didn't think she was harboring murderous impulses or anything. My instincts told me that she was genuinely pleased to help me. After all, that was the first step. And she had patience. She could afford to wait. Dangerous indeed. Lashiel represented nothing less than the intrinsic allure of power itself. I had never sought to become a wizard. Hell, a lot of the time I thought about how nice things might be if I hadn't been one. The power had been a birthright, and if it had grown since then, it had done so by the necessity of survival. But I tasted a darker side to the possession of power, the searing satisfaction of seeing an enemy fall to my strength, the lust to test myself against another, to challenge them and see who was the strongest, the mindless hunger for more that, if once indulged, might never be slaked. One of the coldest, most evil souls I have ever encountered once told me that the reason I fought so hard to do what seemed right was that I was terrified to look within me and see the desire to cease the fight and do as I would, free of conscience or remorse. And now I could see that he had been right. I looked at the fallen angel, patiently waiting, and was terrified. But there were innocent lives at stake, men and women and children who needed protection. If I didn't give it to them, who would? I took a deep breath, reached into my pocket, and found a silver key there. I threw it to my double. He caught it and rose. Then he unlocked Lashiel's shackles. Lashiel inclined her head to him respectfully. Then she walked over to me, gorgeous and warm in the harsh light, her eyes lowered. Without a trace of self-consciousness, she sank down to her knees, bowed her head, and said, "How may I serve you, my host?" I opened my eyes and found myself on my back. There was a candle burning nearby. Mouse had curled himself protectively around my head, and his tongue was flicking over my face, rough and wet and warm. I hurt absolutely everywhere. I'd learned to block out pain under the harsh lessons of Justin de Morn, but it went only so far. Lashiel had shown me a different technique. I couldn't have explained to anyone what I did. I wasn't sure that I understood it myself, at least on a conscious level. I simply knew. I gathered the pain together and fed it into a burning fire of determination in my thoughts, and it began to steadily recede. I exhaled slowly and began to sit up. My brain registered the screaming torture of the muscles in my stomach. It just wasn't horribly important, and took up little of my attention.
"By God, Harry," Butters said.
His voice was thick and slurred, as if he were holding his nose. His hand pushed on my shoulder.
"Don't sit up."
I let him push me back down. I needed a couple of minutes to let the pain continue to fade.
"How bad is it?"
He exhaled.
"It's pretty hideous, but I don't think he actually perforated the abdominal wall. Skin and tissue damage, but you did some bleeding."
He swallowed and looked a little green around the gills.
"That's my best guess, anyway."
"You okay?"
Yeah, fine. It's just, I work with corpses because I just couldn't handle, you know, actual living people."
"Heh, you can eat lunch while looking at a 3-month-old corpse, but first aid on my stomach is too much to handle?"
"Yeah, I mean, you're still alive. That's just weird."
I shook my head. "How long was I out?" I was surprised at how calm and steady my voice sounded.
"It's been about 15 minutes, Butters said. "I found some bandages and alcohol in the old man's duffel bag. I've got your belly cleaned and covered, but I don't have much of an idea of how much trouble you're in. You need a hospital."
"Maybe later," I said. I lay on my back, poring over what Lashiel had given me about the writings in the book. Hell, the thing had been written in German. I didn't know German, but Lashiel had translated the text about the Dark Hallow. It felt like we had talked about it for an hour or more, but dream time and real time aren't always lockstepped. Butters's nose had swollen up. There was still some blood on his face, and he already had a matched set of gorgeously colorful black eyes. He leaned over and fussed with the bandages on my stomach.
"Hey," I said quietly, "I told you to run. I was doing that heroic rearguard thing. You screwed it all up."
"Sorry,"
he answered, his voice serious.
"But I got outside and I couldn't run. I mean, I wanted to. I really wanted to. But after all you've done for me," he shook his head, "I just couldn't do that."
"What did you do?"
"I ran around the outside of the museum. I tried to find help, but with all the rain and the dark, there wasn't anyone around. So I ran to the car and got Mouse. I thought that maybe he could help you."
"He could," I agreed. "He did." Mouse's tail thumped on the floor, and he kept on licking at my head. I realized, dully, that he was cleaning the dozens of tiny snake bites.
"But he couldn't have done it without you, Butters," I said. "You saved my life. Another 5 minutes and I'd have been history."
He blinked down at me for a moment and then said,
"I did, didn't I?"
"Damn brave of you," I said. His spine straightened a little.
"You think?"
"Yeah."
"And check it out,"
he said, gesturing at his face, his mouth opening into a toothy smile.
"I have a broken nose, don't I?"
"Absolutely," I said.
"Like I'm a boxer, or maybe a tough-as-nails gumshoe."
"You earned it," I said. "Hurt?"
"Like hell," he said,
but he was still smiling. He blinked a few times, the gears almost visibly spinning in his head, and said,
I didn't run away. And I fought him. I jumped on him.
I kept quiet and let him process it.
My God, he said. That was so stupid.
Actually, when you survive, it gets reclassified as courageous. I reached out my right hand. Butters shook it, gripping hard. He looked at Cassius's body, and his smile faded.
What about him? He asked.
He's done, I said.
That's not what I mean.
Oh, I said. We'll leave the body here. No time to move it. He'll be a John Doe on the public records, and there probably won't be a heavy investigation.
If we get out quick, it shouldn't be an issue.
No, my God, he's dead. We killed him.
Don't kid yourself, I told him. I'm the one who killed him. All you did was try to help me. His brow furrowed and he shook his head.
That's not what I mean either. I feel sorry for him.
Don't, I said. He was a monster.
Butters frowned and nodded.
But he was also a man. Or was once. He was so bitter. So much hate. He had a horrible life.
Note the past tense, I said. Had. Butters looked away from the corpse.
What happened there at the very end? There was a light, and his voice sounded weird. I thought he'd killed you.
He hit me with his death curse, I said. Butters swallowed.
I guess it didn't work. I mean, because you're breathing.
It worked, I told him. I'd felt that vicious magic grab hold of me and sink in. I don't think he was strong enough to kill me outright, so he went for something else.
Die alone? Butters asked quietly. What does that mean?
I don't know, I said. Not sure I want to. I took a deep breath and then exhaled. I didn't have enough time to lie there waiting to recover. Butters, I don't have any right to ask this of you. I'm already in your debt, but I need your help.
You have it, he said.
I haven't even told you what it is, I said.
Butters smiled a little and nodded.
I know, but you have it.
I felt my lips peel back from my teeth in a fierce grin. One little assault and you've gone habitual. Next thing I know, you'll be forming a fight club. Help me up.
You shouldn't,
he said seriously. No choice, I said. He nodded and then stood up and offered me his hand. I took it and rose, waiting to sway or pass out or throw up from the pain. I did none of those things. The pain was there, but it didn't stop me from moving or thinking. Butters just stared at me and then shook his head. I found my staff, picked it up, and walked to the Buffalo Bill exhibit. Butters got the candle, and then he and Mouse kept pace. I looked around for a second, then picked up a long, heavy-duty extension cord running from an outlet on the wall to power some lights on an exhibit in the center of the room. I jerked it clear at both ends and gathered it into a neat loop. Once I had it, I passed it to Butters.
What are you doing?
He asked. Preparing, I said. I found out about the Dark Hollow. Butters blinked.
You did? How?
I grunted.
Magic.
Okay, he said. What did you learn?
That this isn't a rite. It's a big spell, I said. It all depends on drawing together a ton of dark spiritual energy.
Like what?
He asked.
Like a lot of things. The necromantic energy around animated corpses and manifested shades, the predatory spirits of ancient hunters, all the fear that's been growing since last night, plus the past several years have seen some serious magical turbulence around Chicago. Kemmler's disciples can put that turbulence to work for them, too.
Then what?
They gather it together and get it going in a big circle. It creates a kind of vortex, which then funnels down into whoever is trying to consume the energy. Poof, insta-god.
He frowned.
I'm not very clued in on this magic stuff, but that sounds kind of dangerous.
Hell yeah, I said, and crossed the room to a rack of writing equipment. It's like trying to inhale a tornado.
Holy crap,
Butters said.
But how does that help us?
First of all, I found out that the vortex itself is deadly. It's going to draw off the life of every living thing around it.
Butters gulped. It will kill everything?
Not at first, but when the wizard at the vortex draws down the power, it's going to create a kind of vacuum where all that power used to be. The vacuum will rip away the life energy of everything within a mile.
Dear God, that will kill thousands of people.
Only if they finish the spell, I said. Until then, the farther back you are from it, the less it will do, I said. But to get near the vortex, the only way to survive it is to surround yourself with necromantic energy of your own.
Only those with ghosts or zombies need apply? He asked.
Exactly. I lifted a saddle from the rack. Then I got a second one. I hung both over opposite ends of my staff and picked it up like a plowman's yoke, the saddles hanging. I started walking down the stairs.
But wait,
Butters said.
What are you going to do?
Get to the center of the vortex, I said. The effort it will take to work this spell is incredible. I don't care how good Cowl is. If I hit him as he tries to draw down the vortex, it's going to shake his concentration. The spell will be ruined. The backlash will kill him.
And everyone will be all right?
He asked. That's the plan. He nodded, and then stopped abruptly in his tracks. I felt his stare burning into my back.
But, Harry, to get there, you'll have to call up the dead yourself.
I stopped and looked over my shoulder at him. Comprehension dawned in his eyes.
And you need a drummer.
Yeah. He swallowed.
Could you get in trouble with your people for doing this?
It's possible, I said, but there's a technicality I can exploit.
What do you mean?
The laws of magic specifically refer to the abuse of magic when used against our fellow human beings. Technically, it only counts if you call up human corpses.
But you told me that everyone only calls humans.
Right. So, while the laws of magic only address necromancy as used on human corpses, there usually isn't any need for a distinction. Nutty necromancers only call up humans. Sane wizards don't touch necromancy at all. I don't think anyone has tried something like this. We reached the main level of the museum. It's going to be dangerous, I told him. I think we can do it, but I can't make you any promises. I don't know if I can protect you. Butters walked beside me for several steps, his expression serious.
You can't try it without someone's help, and if you don't stop it, the spell will kill thousands of people.
Yes, I said, but I can't order you to help me. I can only ask. He licked his lips.
I can keep a beat, he said.
I nodded and reached my destination. I slipped my improvised yoke off my shoulders and dropped both saddles to the floor. My breathing was a little harsh from the effort, even though I barely noticed the pain and strain. You'll need a drum. Butters nodded.
There were some tom-toms upstairs. I'll go get one.
I shook my head. Too high-pitched. Your polka suit is still in the beetle's trunk, right?
Yes.
I nodded. Then I looked up. And up and up. Another flash of lightning illuminated the pale, towering terror of Sue, the most complete Tyrannosaurus skeleton mankind has ever discovered. Okay, Butters, I told him. Go get it.
Chapter 39. By the time we got outside, the storm had turned into something with its own vicious will. Rain lashed down in blinding cold sheets. Wind howled like a starving beast. Lightning burned almost continually across the sky, and the accompanying thunder was a constant rumbling snarl. This was the kind of storm that came only once or twice in a century, and I had never seen its equal. That said, the entire thing was nothing but a side effect of the magical forces now at work over the city. The apprehension, tension, fear, and anger of its people had coalesced into dark power that rode over Chicago in the storm. The Earl King's presence, I could still hear the occasional shrieking howl amidst the storm's angry roaring, stirred that energy even more. I shielded my eyes from the rain as best I could with one hand, staring up at the lightning-threaded skies. There, a few miles to the north, I found what I had expected. A slow and massive rotation in the storm clouds, a spiral of fire and air and water that rolled with ponderous grace through its cycle.
There!
I called back to Butters and pointed.
You see it?
My God,
he said. He clutched at my shoulders with both hands to hold himself steady, and his bass drum pulsed steadily behind me.
Is that it?
That's it,
I growled. I shook the water from my eyes and clutched at the saddle horn to keep my balance.
It's starting.
What a mess,
Butters said. He glanced behind us at the broken brick and debris and wreckage of the museum's front doors.
Is she all right?
One way to find out, I growled. Hyah, mule!
I laid my left hand on the rough, pebbled skin of my steed and willed it forward. The saddle lurched and I clutched hard with my other hand to stay on. The first few steps were the worst. The saddle sat at a sharp incline, not too unlike that on a rearing horse. But as my mount gathered speed, the length of her body tilted forward until her spine was almost parallel with the ground. I didn't know this before, but as it turns out, tyrannosaurs can really haul ass. She might have been as long as a city bus, but Sue, despite her weight, moved with power and grace. As I'd called forth energy-charged ectoplasm to clothe the ancient bones, they had become covered in sheets of muscle and a hide of heavy, surprisingly supple quasi-flesh. She was dark gray, and there was a ripple pattern of black along her head, back, and flanks, almost like that of a jaguar. And once I had shaped the vessel, I had reached out and found the ancient spirit of the predator that had animated it in life. Animals might not have the potential power of human remains, but the older the remains, the more magic can be drawn to fill them. And Sue was 65 million years old. She had power. She had power in spades. I had rigged the saddles to straddle her spine, just at the bend where neck joined body. I'd had to improvise to get them around her, using the long extension cords to tie them into place, and it had been ticklish as hell to get Butters on board without his losing the beat and destroying my control of the dino zombie. But Butters had pulled through. Sue bellowed out a basso shriek that rattled nearby buildings and broke a few windows as she hurtled forward down the streets of the city. The blinding rain and savage storm had left the streets all but deserted, but even so there were earthquakes less noticeable than a freaking tyrannosaur. The streets literally shook under her feet. In fact, we left acres of strained, cracked asphalt behind us. Here's something else I bet you didn't know about tyrannosaurs. They don't corner well. The first time I tried to take a left, Sue swung wide, the enormous momentum of her body simply too much for even her muscles to lightly command. She swung up onto the sidewalk, crushed three parked cars under her feet, knocked over two light poles, kicked a compact car end over end to land on its roof, and broke every window on the first two floors of the building beside us as her tail lashed back and forth in an effort to counterbalance her body.
Oh my God!
Butters screamed. He kept hanging on to me with his arms, stabbing his legs out alternately to either side in order to operate the bass drum strapped on his back.
They're probably insured, I shouted.
Thank God the streets weren't crowded that night. I made a note to be sure to have Sue slow down a little before we turned again, and kept the focus of my will on her, her attention on the task at hand. Just before we turned onto Lakeshore Drive, we hit a National Guard checkpoint. There were a couple of army Hummers there, their headlights casting useless cones of light into the night and storm, wooden roadblocks, and two luckless GIs in rain ponchos. As Sue bore down on them, the two men stared, their faces white. One of them simply dropped his assault rifle from numb hands.
"Get out of the way, fools!"
I screamed. The two men dove for cover. Sue's foot crashed down onto the hood of one Hummer, crushing it to the asphalt, and then we were past the checkpoint and pounding our way down the street toward Evanston.
Ha!
I said, looking back over my shoulder. I'd love to hear how they explain that to their CO.
You crushed that truck!
Butters shouted.
You're like a human wrecking ball!
There was a thoughtful pause, and then he said,
Hey, are we going anywhere near my boss's place? Because he just won't shut up about his new Jaguar.
Maybe later. For now, look sharp, I told him. She's a lot faster than I thought. We'll be there in just a minute.
I ducked under the corner of a billboard as Sue went by it,
Whatever you do, keep that drumbeat going. Do you understand? Right, Butters said. If I stop, no more dinosaur. No, I called back. If you stop, the dinosaur does whatever the hell it wants to. Shouts rose up from a side street where a couple more guardsmen saw us go by. Sue turned her head toward them and let out another challenging bellow that broke more windows and startled the guardsmen so much that they fell down. I felt a surge of simple, enormous hunger run through the beast I'd called up, as though the ancient animus I'd summed up from the spirit world was beginning to remember the finer things in life. I touched Sue's neck again, sending a surge of my will down into her, jerking her head back around with a rumbling cough of protest. My ears rang in the wake of that vast sound, and I glanced over my shoulder to make sure Butters was okay. His face was pale.
If this thing gets loose, he said, that would be bad.
Which is why you shouldn't stop the drum, I told him. If Sue went wild, I could scarcely imagine the potential carnage she could inflict. I mean, good grief. Look at all the senseless victims in Jurassic Park 2. We hit Evanston, the first suburb of Chicago proper, which is mainly separated from Chicago by the presence of trees on the streets and a few more homes than high-rises. But given that it's only a block or two away from the heart of Second City, the addition of trees and homes made it feel more like a park nestled down at the feet of the city. I guided Sue into a gentler left turn onto Sheridan, slowing down enough to be sure that we wouldn't swerve off the street. As Sue headed in, I was suddenly struck with a realization of how fragile those homes seemed. Good Lord, another driving accident like the one back in town would result in a home being crushed and not just some dents and broken windows. We would be moving among precisely the people I was trying to protect. Families. Homes with children and parents and pets and grandparents. Decent folks, for the most part, who just wanted to make their homes peaceful and secure and go about their lives. Of course, if I didn't hurry up and stop the Dark Hollow, every house I was now passing would be filled with its dead. I checked the sky during the next long flicker of lightning and didn't like what I saw. The clouds were spinning faster, more broadly, and unnatural colors and striations had appeared in their formation, and we were almost under its center. I guided Sue down another side street, and that's when I felt the cloud of power gathering before me. It swirled and writhed against my wizard senses, sending tingling shafts of heat and cold and other less recognizable sensations running through me. I shuddered at the disorienting strength of it. There was magic being wrought ahead. A lot of it.
There!
Butters shouted, pointing.
Down that way! That whole block is the campus!
Lightning flashed again as I turned Sue down the street, and it was over the dinosaur's broad head that I saw wardens battling for their lives in the street ahead. They were in trouble. Lucio had them moving in a tight group around a cluster of Hell's Bells, around a group of children in colorful Halloween costumes. Morgan was at the head of the group, Lucio brought up the rear, and Yoshimo, Kowalski, and Ramirez were on the flanks. Even as I watched, I saw dozens of rotting forms lurch out of the shadows ahead of them and charge. More came running in behind them, letting out wails of mad anger. Lucio whirled to deal with them, and dear God, I suddenly saw the difference between a strong but somewhat clumsy young wizard and a master of the magic of battle. Fire lashed from her left hand, not a gout of flame like I could call up, but a slender needle of fire so bright that it hurt the eyes to see. She swept it in an arc at thigh level, and every one of the zombies coming behind went tumbling to the ground amidst crackling sounds of shattering muscle and singeing meat. Another wave surged up behind the first. Lucio caught one of them in a grip of invisible power and hurled the undead into the ones behind, sending more of them to the ground. But a pair of the zombies got through. Lucio ducked the grasping arms of the first, caught the thing by a wrist, and sent it stumbling aside with a twist of her body that reminded me of one of Murphy's moves. The second zombie drove a hammer-heavy blow at her head, but that slender blade she wore at her side swept up out of its scabbard and took off its arm at the elbow. Another move brought a chiming surge of some power I could feel even from half a block away, singing through the silver steel of her sword, and she flicked it lightly at the zombie's head. The blade touched, there was a flash of light, and the zombie abruptly fell limp to the ground, the magic that had animated it disrupted and gone. In less than 5 seconds, Lucio had simply wiped out 30 undead, and it hadn't even been a contest. I guess you don't get to be commander of the wardens by collecting bottle caps either. My eyes flickered back to the front of the group, where Morgan met the shock of another wave. His style was rougher and more brutal than Lucio's, but he got similar results. A heavy stomp of his foot sent a ripple through the earth that knocked undead to the ground like bowling pins. A gesture of his hand and wrist and a cry of effort drew grasping waves of concrete and earth up to clamp down on the fallen zombies. He closed his fist and the earth tightened, drawing back down into the ground, cutting and tearing its way through undead flesh and ripping the zombies to shreds. One of the creatures was still mobile, and with a look of contemptuous impatience on his face, Morgan drew the broadsword at his hip, the one used for executions of wizards, guilty of breaking one of the laws of magic, paused a beat to get the timing right, and then swung once, twice, snicker snack, and the zombie fell apart into a number of wriggling bits. Several others got through here and there. Kowalski hammered one to the ground with unseen force, while beside him Yoshimo twisted a hand and the branches of a nearby tree reached down of their own accord, wrapped around the undead's throat, and hauled it up off the ground. Ramirez, a fighter's grin on his face, lashed out with some kind of bright green energy I'd never seen before, and the zombie nearest him simply fell apart into what looked like grains of sand. As an afterthought, he drew his sidearm as a second creature charged him and calmly put two rounds into its head from less than 10 feet away. He must have been loaded up with hollow points or something, because the creature's head exploded like rotten fruit and the rest fell twitching to the ground. None of the zombies got within 10 feet of the terrified children. More of them materialized out of the rain and the night, but Lucio and the wardens kept moving steadily forward, burning and crushing and slicing and dicing their way across the street, furiously determined to get the children clear. Which is probably why they didn't see the sucker punch coming. Out of nowhere, there was the roar of an engine and an old Chrysler shot forward along the street. The driver pulled it into a sharp left turn as it got close to the wardens and their charges, and the wet rain turned it into a broadside slide. The car swept forward like an enormous broom of iron and steel, and none of the wardens were looking that way. I cried out to Sue and hung on to the saddle horn. The car slid, sending out a bow wave of sheeting water from the wet street. Ramirez's head snapped around toward the car, and he shrieked a warning. But it was too late to get out of the way. The group was still under attack, and the mindless creations that assaulted them cared nothing for self-preservation. They would continue the fight, and even if the wardens could have run from the car, they would never survive being mobbed by the undead in the chaos. In a flash of insight, I realized that these were the same tactics Gravain had used at my apartment, ruthlessly sacrificing minions in order to defeat the enemy. Everyone else's head turned toward the oncoming car. The muscles of Sue's legs tensed, and the saddle lurched. One of the little girls screamed. And then the Tyrannosaur came down from the leap that had carried her over the besieged wardens. Sue landed with one clawed foot on the street, and the other came down squarely on the caddy's hood, like a falcon descending upon a rabbit. There was an enormous sound of shrieking metal and breaking glass, and the saddle lurched wildly again. I leaned over to see what had happened. The car's hood and engine block had been compacted into a 2-foot-thick section of twisted metal. Even as I looked, Sue leaned over the car in a curiously bird-like movement, opened her enormous jaws, and ripped the roof off. Inside was Li Xian, dressed in a black shirt and trousers. The ghoul's forehead had a nasty gash in it, and green-black blood had sheeted over one side of his face. His eyes were blank and a little vague, and I figured he'd clipped his head on the steering wheel or window when Sue brought his sliding car to an abrupt halt. Li Xian shook his head and then started to scramble out of the car. Sue roared again, and the sound must have terrified Li Xian, because all of his limbs jerked in spasm, and he fell on his face to the street. Sue leaned down again, her jaws gaping, but the ghoul rolled under the car to get away from them. So Sue kicked the car and sent it tumbling end over end 3 or 4 times down the street. The ghoul let out a scream and stared up at Sue in naked terror, covering his head with his arms. Sue ate him. Snap, gulp, no more ghoul.
"What's with that?"
Butters screamed, his voice high and frightened.
"Just covering his head with his arms? Didn't he see the lawyer in the movie?"
Those who do not learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them, I replied, turning Sue around. Hang on!
I rode the dinosaur into the stream of zombies following in the warden's wake and let her go to town. Sue chomped and stomped and smacked zombies 50 feet through the air with swinging blows of her snout. Her tail batted one particularly vile-looking zombie into the brick wall of the nearest building, and the zombie hit so hard and so squishily that it just stuck to the wall like a refrigerator magnet, arms and legs spread into sprawl. In a couple of minutes, there wasn't much in the way of zombies to keep on demolishing, so I swung Sue around to pace after the wardens. They had gotten clear of the street while I covered their retreat, and I saw Warden Lucio at the door of the nearest building, waving the last two children and Ramirez through the door while she watched out behind. I guided Sue up to the building and had her settle down to the ground.
Come on, but keep the drum going, I told Butters.
We slid out of our saddles and ran a couple of steps through the heavy rain to where Lucio stood at the door.
Hey there, I said. Sorry I'm late.
Lucio stared at me for a moment and then at the dinosaur. Her eyes held a mixture of wonder, anger, gratitude, and revulsion.
I... Dio, Dresden. What have you done?
It isn't immortal, I said. It's an animal. You know the laws are there to protect our fellow wizards and mortals.
It's... She looked like she might throw up. It's necromancy, she said.
It's necessary, I said, and my voice sounded harsh. I hooked a thumb up. You've seen the vortex forming?
Yes. What is it?
Dark power. Kemmler's people are going to call it down and devour it, along with all the shades they could get to show up. And if they go through with it and turn one of themselves into a god...
Lucio's eyes widened as she figured it out and caught on.
There will be a vacuum, she said. It will draw in magic to replace it. It will draw in life.
Right, I said. And they're going to be over there, directly under the vortex, I said. But if anyone tries to go in without a field of necromantic energy around them, the vortex will suck them dry before they get there. We need to get in there to stop them. That's why I borrowed Tiny here. So don't give me any crap about the laws of magic, or at least wait for later, because there are too many lives at stake.
Anger flickered over her face, and she opened her mouth. Then she frowned and closed it again.
Where did you get this information?
Kemmler's book, I said.
You found it?
I grimaced. Briefly. Gravain jumped me and took it.
Butters looked back and forth between us, marching in place to make the polka suit's drum beat. Lucio blinked at him, took a deep breath, then said,
And who is this?
The drummer I needed to pull this off, I told her. And a good friend. He saved my life tonight.
Butters, this is Miss Lucio. Captain, this is Butters.
Lucio gave Butters a courtly little bow, and he ducked his head sheepishly in reply.
Where'd you find those kids? I asked.
She grimaced. This building is an apartment complex. We got here just as the first of the undead arose. One of the parents was screaming about the children being at some sort of Halloween party in a building on campus. We were too late to save the women taking care of them, but at least we got the children out.
I chewed on my lip, studying the warden.
You had evil wizards to gun down, and you stopped to get some kids out of the line of fire? I figured wardens would have melted the bad guys first, tried to get the civilians clear later.
She lifted her chin and regarded me with an arched brow.
Is that how you think of us?
Yes, I said.
She frowned and looked down at the hilt of her sword.
Dresden. The wardens are not, as a rule, concerned with compassion or empathy, but they were children. I am not proud of my every act as a warden, but I would sooner hurl myself to the demons than leave a child to die.
I frowned at her.
You would, I said thoughtfully.
Wouldn't you?
She smiled a little, her iron-gray hair plastered to her head with the rain, and it made many wrinkles at the corners of her eyes.
Not all of us share Morgan's attitudes, but even he would never have turned aside from children in danger. He is an enormous ass at times, but a brilliant soldier, and beneath all his flaws, a decent man.
The door to the building slammed open, and Morgan came through, sword gripped in both hands.
I told you, he said viciously to Lucio. I told you he would turn on us. This latest violation of the laws only proves what I've said all along.
His voice trailed off slowly as he caught me from the corner of his eye and turned to see me standing there, and Sue crouched a couple of yards behind me.
Yeah, I told Lucio, and my voice was the only dry thing about me. I see what you mean.
Morgan, he found the book, she looked at me. Tell him.
I relayed everything I had learned to Morgan. He glowered at me with enormous suspicion, but by the time I got to the part where thousands of people would die if we failed to stop the spell, his face became drawn with anxiety and then hardened with determination. He listened without interrupting.
We need to get to the center of the spell, I finished. Attack them just as they try to draw it down.
It's impossible, Morgan said. I got close enough to see them when we went in for the children. They're in a little patch of grass and picnic tables between the buildings. There are several hundred animated corpses in our way.
As it happens, I said, jerking my head at Sue, I brought an animated corpse countermeasure along with me tonight. I'll get us through.
Morgan stared at me for a second and then nodded, the idea clearly gathering momentum in his thoughts.
Yes, then. We try to hit them as they complete the spell. That gives them the most time to backstab one another, and if we disrupt the working that powerful, the backlash will probably kill them.
Agreed, Lucio said. How's Yoshimo?
Ramirez says her thigh is broken, Morgan growled. She's not in danger, but she won't be doing any more fighting tonight.
Damn it, Lucio said. I should have caught that one before it went through.
No, Captain, Morgan said implacably. She should never have tried her sword on it. She was an unremarkable fencer at best.
Gosh, you're a sweetheart, Morgan, I said.
He glared at me, and the sword quivered in his hands. Lucio brought her hand down between us in a gesture of absolute authority.
Gentlemen, she said quietly, later. We've no time.
Morgan took a deep breath in and then nodded. I folded my arms and kept up my glower, but I hadn't been the one near violence. Point Dresden.
I've done for Gervain's drummer, and Sue just ate Corpse Taker's sidekick, I said. That leaves us with those two and Cal plus Cal's assistant.
Four of them and five of us, Morgan said.
Lucio grimaced.
It could be worse, she admitted. But only you and I have any experience with this kind of fight, she glanced at me. No offense, Dresden, but you are young, and you haven't seen this kind of duel very often. But even you have more experience than Ramirez or Kowalski.
None taken, I said, beginning to shiver in the rain. I'd rather be home in bed.
Morgan, please get the other wardens and fill them in. Then put Yoshimo where she can see the front door and defend the building. If things don't go well, we may need somewhere to fall back.
If things don't go well, I said, we really won't have to worry about that.
Morgan shook his head at me. I'll be right back.
I stood there for a moment. A mangled zombie wandered up the sidewalk. I walked back to Sue and touched her flank in her thoughts, and she flicked her tail, batting the thing away into the darkness. Then I walked back over to Lucio.
Incredible, she said quietly, looking at Sue. Dresden, this kind of magic is an abomination. Perhaps a necessary one this night, but hideous all the same. And yet, look at it. It's amazing.
Pretty good for zombie crushing, too, I said.
Indeed. She looked up at the sky again. How will we know when they begin drawing down the power?
I started to say, your guess is as good as mine, but I didn't get any of it out of my mouth before the clouds rolled and stirred and suddenly began to spin in a single enormous spiral. More lightning showed me the dim form of what looked like a thin, almost spidery tornado that dropped from the cloud and began to descend to the ground. I stiffened and nodded at it.
There you go, I said. They're starting now.
Very well, Lucio said. Then we must move at once. I want you to... Lucio didn't get to tell me what she wanted me to do, because the earth suddenly boiled with writhing masses of pale green light that came surging up out of the ground. They took on form as they came, first vaguely human, then, over the next instants, resolving into clearer images of what looked like Amaran tribesmen. As they came, their mouths opened in shrieks and wails of excitement and rage, and ghostly weapons appeared in their hands, spears and hatchets, clubs and bows. One of them turned and threw a translucent, shimmering spear at my chest. I barely had time to think, but my left arm swept up. My charred shield bracelet exploded into a cloud of blue and white sparks, and the hurled spear shattered into angry green flames against my shield. I heard a short cry beside me and ducked, narrowly avoiding a swing from a spectral hatchet whose wielder floated over me. I threw myself forward and rolled, coming up with my shield ready and my will gathering in my staff, making the sigils carved along its length glow with sullen fire. A specter swung a club at Lucio, and she rolled with the blow, but even so took a hit to her jaw and mouth that staggered her. She recovered her balance, ducked to avoid a second swing, and once more drew the silver sword of a warden from her hip. Again the blade sang with that buzzing power I'd sensed before, and Lucio made a clean lunge at the specter that thrust the blade through its heart. The specter arched as if in agony and simply exploded into flashes of sickly light and falling globs of ectoplasm. Lucio swept her sword back and spun on a heel to face two more of the quasi-solid spirits. I blocked a second blow of the hatchet on my shield, looking wildly around for Butters. I spotted the little guy 5 yards away, on his hands and knees on the crosswalk, his legs still kicking wildly to keep the drum going. 3 of the deadly specters were closing in on him with wails of madness and rage. "Butters!" I shouted and rose to go to him, but 2 more specters dove at me and forced me to crouch behind my shield. I could only watch what happened as the 3 undead swarmed Butters and attacked him. Butters spun around wildly, his eyes down, evidently not even aware that they were coming. One of them swung a great 2-handed club back as Butters put 1 hand to his mouth and then slammed it back down on the ground again. The specter's weapon swept down with a clean and lethal grace, heading directly for the back of Butters' head, and suddenly shattered against the curving curtain of an empowered circle. Butters looked up at the specters as they flailed uselessly against the circle. He had the piece of chalk I'd given him in 1 hand, and he'd torn the little cut he'd used before open once more with his teeth. He stood up, the drum still thumping, and gave me a shaky thumbs up. "Good Butters!" I shouted at him. "Stay in there!" He nodded, his face pale, and marched in place to keep the drum going. I swung my staff at a specter and hit it, and the ghostly warrior reacted as if struck by a heavy brick. It was a curious kind of impact, not the thudding thump of hitting something solid, but some kind of impact nonetheless. I knew from the way that the specters had come up through the earth that they were only partially material. A material impact would have little enough effect on them, and the strength of my arm behind the swing meant nothing to them. But the power of my will that I had called up and held ready in my staff, that was something else. That energy was what the specter reacted to, and I pressed my advantage, whipping my staff through the specter's head and belly on 2 separate swings, driving the apparition away with howls of pain. In the time it took me to do that, Lucio had simply dispatched 3 more of the specters with the humming power of her warden's blade. She looked at me, her eyes wide, and lifted a pointing finger. She snarled a word, and another searing thread of flame shot over my shoulder about 8 inches from my right ear. There was a howl, and I turned my head to see another specter that had been charging my back fall, consumed in scarlet flame. I felt a fierce grin on my face, and I turned around to nod my thanks to Lucio, and saw the corpse taker come out from under a veil of magic and swing her drawn tulwar at Lucio's back.
"Captain!"
I shouted. Lucio's sword arm swept up and around, blade parallel to her spine, as she drew it around her shoulders in a circle and caught Corpse Taker's attack without even turning to face it. Lucio sprang forward like a cat and spun in place, only to have Corpse Taker press her attack and drive the captain of the wardens back on her heels. Corpse Taker's young face was set in a wide and manic smile, cheeks dimpled, her curly hair flying wildly around her head as she charged. She wore a small skin drum of some kind on a rig at her hip, and she beat a swift tattoo on it with 1 hand while fighting with the other. A fresh cloud of specters swirled up in support of her, and a flying arrow drew a line of scarlet on Lucio's cheek. I roared out a challenge, brandishing my staff, and bellowed,
"For Zori!"
A lance of unseen force lashed out at Corpse Taker, but the necromancer leapt back and away from it. She cried out words in an unknown tongue, and 6 specters darted toward me. I brought up my shield, but was soon hard-pressed to even hold it up against repeated attacks from the specters, and they kept trying to circle around me. If I'd stood my ground, they would have killed me, and as much as I wanted to help Lucio, I had no choice but to take one step back after another until I found my shoulders pressed against Sue's enormous flank. But my attack on the corpse-taker had bought Lucio what she needed to make a fight of things, time to recover from the surprise attack. She cut down two more specters with needles of flame, contemptuously slapped aside another cut from corpse-taker's tulwar, and then took the battle to the necromancer, gray cloak flying in the storm's wind, pressing her hard with the silver rapier and driving corpse-taker back one step after another. I dropped the staff and slapped my bare hand on Sue's hide. Though the dinosaur looked like a living beast, that was only appearance. Her own flesh was made of the same ectoplasm that the specters were. I had just poured enough energy into it to make it seem more solid. She was of the same stuff as the specters, and that meant that she could hurt them. The tyrannosaur stirred and then snapped her jaws to one side, closing on a specter and tearing it into fading light and globs of goo. She heaved herself to her feet, eyes sweeping around the ground in front of her for the next specter. It lifted a bow and loosed a glowing green arrow that sunk into the muscle of her neck, and she bellowed in pain, but the arrow was no more than a bee's sting. One clawed foot came up and down and destroyed a second specter. The others let out wails and shouts of fear and anger and spread out to attack Sue, while the dinosaur lashed her tail around and looked for the next victim. I saw Lucio drive corpse-taker forward and around the corner of the building out of sight. I'd given the specters a bigger problem to worry about, and I went after Lucio.
"Harry!"
Butters shouted, pointing. I looked up at the building. I heard children screaming inside. Someone, Ramirez, I thought, screamed,
"Get down! Get down!"
There were flashes of luminous green light swirling here and there in the windows. I heard Morgan shout a challenge, and I heard a raucous booming sound from within. The wardens there were under attack as well.
"Stay put!"
I told him, and ran after Lucio. It was too thick with shadow to see easily around the side of the building, but in a flash of lightning, I saw Lucio make another lunge, her technique gorgeous, back legs stretched forward, spine straight, the sword extended and taking the full weight of her body behind its vicious tip. Lucio knew what she was doing. She dipped the tip of her blade under corpse-taker's tulwar, and the point sank into the necromancer just under the floating ribs. Corpse-taker's mad smile never faltered. The lightning died away, and I heard a short, gasping cry. I took my mother's pentacle in hand and lifted it, willing light from it. Silver-blue light filled the little space between buildings. I saw Lucio plant her feet, twist the blade viciously, and whip it back out again. Corpse-taker fell to her knees. She stared down at her chest and then pressed her hands tightly to the wound. She looked up again, staring at Lucio and then at me. Her eyes clouded over with confusion, and she slowly toppled to her side on the grass.
"Excellent,"
said Lucio, turning around. She flicked blood from the silver blade and regarded it for a moment, then strode with purposeful steps for the front of the building again.
"Come, wizard. We have no time to waste."
"You're going to leave her there?"
"She's finished,"
Lucio said harshly. "Come." "Are you all right?" I said. She shot a hard look at me.
"Perfectly. Gravain and Cowl remain. We must find them and kill them."
Her eyes flicked to the spiraling clouds overhead.
"And quickly. We have only moments. Hurry, fool."
I stood there for a second, staring at Lucio's back. I lifted the pentacle and looked at corpse-taker's body, lying on its side in the rain. She twitched a little, her dark eyes wide and staring blindly, her face pale. And my stomach twisted in sudden fear. I stepped around the corner of the building with my .44 in my hand, aimed it at the back of Lucio's head, drew back the hammer, and shouted, my voice harsh and hard,
"Corpse-taker!"
Lucio's steps faltered. Her head snapped around to look at me, and in her eyes I saw a brutal cruelty that could never have belonged to the captain of the wardens. I felt the first tug of a soul gaze, but I made my decision in the moment that my voice caused her steps to falter. She opened her mouth, and I saw the corpse-taker's madness twist Lucio's eyes, felt the sudden dark tension as she began to gather power. She never got it. In that single second of uncertainty, Corpse Taker had been relying upon her disguise to defend her, and had her mind bent upon planning her next step, not preparing her death curse. The bullet from my .44